It's Wednesday, March 27, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As expected, the oral arguments yesterday before the United States Supreme Court did not disappoint in terms of being an exchange between the justices and the attorneys arguing the case on some of the most fundamental issues at stake in the question of the legalization of same-sex marriage. Yesterday, the oral arguments concerned the case, which is a challenge to the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8. Today, the same justices will hear oral arguments presented in both sides defending and attacking the Defense of Marriage Act in terms of its constitutionality. The Defense of Marriage Act, you'll recall, was passed overwhelmingly by both houses of Congress in 1996 and then signed into law by former President Bill Clinton. What we're looking at here are two cases which will be decided in one way or another by this court. That decision will inevitably, or those decisions taken together, have an enormous effect upon this nation, setting the trajectory, at least in terms of constitutional questions, related to the legalization of same-sex marriage for any number of years to come. In other words, all Americans had a great deal at stake in terms of the oral arguments before the court yesterday. Americans who listened to the recording later released by the court may have been surprised by the tenor of the conversation. It's not a dispassionate academic conversation amongst legal scholars. It is a very passionate conversation in which you have, on the one hand, justices of the court able to ask questions of the attorneys, and then you have the attorneys squirming and certainly maneuvering to come up with an answer that will meet the constitutional expectations of the justice asking the question. The first and foremost question coming before the court yesterday had to do with the question of standing. As many in the media have acknowledged, and virtually any informed person now knows, the big question in terms of the court is whether it will try to rule narrowly one way or another on the issue, perhaps limiting the effect of its decision to the state of California in the Proposition 8 case, or whether it will release a sweeping decision one way or the other that would have an effect upon all 50 states, either immediately or in the short term. But the reality is that even as the temptation is to listen to the oral arguments in order to find clues for where the justices will land, that's a dangerous proposition. But what did take place, indisputably, was an exchange of ideas, and that is revealing in and of itself. The issue of standing was first and foremost. The issue of standing is crucial because standing is required for someone to make an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. If the court rules that no one has the standing, the constitutional right to come before that court with this kind of appeal, then the case is thrown out. And if that happens, then the lower court decisions nullifying Proposition 8, the decision of a San Francisco federal district court, and the decision of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, well, those decisions will simply stand, and Proposition 8 will be nullified. But there will be no effect upon the other 49 states. Now, the question of standing, interestingly, came up yesterday from both sides of the ideological divide on the U.S. Supreme Court. You had both liberal and conservative jurists who pressed the issue of standing to both attorneys, and they were asking the question, in all likelihood, having two very different purposes in mind. But, as was indicated in the exchange, especially on the liberal side with Justices Breyer and Kagan, and on the conservative side with Justices Kennedy and Scalia, what you had was the assessment, and it was probably best signaled by the Chief Justice himself, John Roberts, that the issue of standing is going to be dealt with before anything else can be considered by the court. If, however, the court does think that there was someone with standing to appeal the case, and thus it will decide the case, well, that's where the other exchanges in terms of the oral arguments will take on a new significance. Among those exchanges were, for instance, the exchange pressed by Justice Scalia, who asked Attorney Ted Olson, who's arguing for the unconstitutionality of Proposition 8, when same-sex couples acquired a fundamental right to marry. He wanted to know the date. It's a very interesting question because, after all, those who are arguing for the legalization of same-sex marriage are doing so because they are arguing that there has been an evolution in our culture, an arc of progressive direction in our culture by which there has been an increasing understanding of the fundamental rights that are acquired by these groups or should have been seen from the beginning. So what you had here was Ted Olson arguing to the Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, that he couldn't give a date when same-sex couples acquired this fundamental right, but he said the same would be true when it came to interracial marriage or when it came to the larger issue of racism and civil rights, when it was recognized that protected groups had fundamental rights that the court had not recognized before. One of the most interesting and perceptive points made by the justices was made by Associate Justice Samuel Alito, who made the very important point that same-sex marriage is so recent that societies had very little time to understand the effect of such a major social change. For instance, in his statement, which was really in the context of addressing a question to one of the attorneys, Justice Alito mentioned that same-sex marriage is actually more recent even than the technological innovations of the cell phone and the internet. How in the world, he said, with such a recent innovation, can society have any assurance or base in evidence of the effect the legalization of same-sex marriage would bring about? Both sides made their arguments yesterday in terms of Proposition 8. The oral arguments have now come to a close, but only in that case. Today, the issue before the U.S. Supreme Court and those very same justices is going to be the Defense of Marriage Act, and it's going to be very interesting to see the progression of that argument, which we'll be able to review as we come to the briefing tomorrow. At my website at albertmoeller.com, yesterday I posted a major article and analysis entitled Marriage in the Dock, the Supreme Court Considers Same-Sex Marriage. I mentioned that back in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court first made reference to the issue of same-sex marriage by dismissing a case with the words, quote, "the appeal is dismissed for want of a substantial federal question." But when it comes to DOMA, which is a federal law, it is a substantial federal question. And thus, the court, unlike in the situation related to Proposition 8 yesterday, is going to have to face the DOMA question head on. There is the question of standing in this, too, because after all, President Obama has ordered his own attorney general not to defend the law in court. But the House of Representatives has hired its own attorneys, and since it was certainly a party to the legislation, it's hard to imagine that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to say that the House of Representatives, its supposed co-equal in government, does not have standing to make an appeal to the unconstitutionality of one of its own acts. But there are also other issues in the article that I published yesterday. Again, it's Marriage in the Dock, the Supreme Court Considers Same-Sex Marriage. I mention in this particular article that at least three of the sitting justices of the U.S. Supreme Court have mentioned their concern lest the court overreach. For instance, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's one of the court's more liberal jurists, has warned that the court harmed its credibility in 1973 when it handed down the Roe v. Wade decision. Referring to her understanding of the court, Columbia Law School professor Jamal Green told The New Yorker that Ginsburg, quote, "fundamentally does not believe that large-scale social change should come from the courts," end quote. Well, we're about to see. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is widely considered to be a swing vote, said this, quote, "a democracy should not be dependent for its major decisions on what 9 unelected people from a narrow legal background have to say," end quote. And from the conservative side of the court, Justice Antonin Scalia has commented, quote, "it is one of the unhappy incidents of the federal system that a self-righteous Supreme Court acting on its members' personal view of what would make a more perfect union can impose its own favored social and economic dispositions nationwide," end quote. I mention these statements once again because we're about to find out when the decisions of the court related to these two cases become public in just a matter of months, whether any of the three justices actually believed what they said in these statements. Time will tell. There are other issues that should be headline news, or at least should have the attention of Christians concerned with the implications of the Christian worldview in contemporary events. One of those has to do with an incident that recently occurred on MSNBC, the cable news channel. One of its commentators, Melissa Harris Perry, was making a comment about abortion. She was referring to controversy over the fact that several states are adopting more restrictive laws on abortion. She clearly was outraged by this and was giving support to arguments that the states ought not to do this, but rather should simply trust women, to use her language, to make responsible decisions. She talked, as is reported in several news sources, about how much it costs, quote, "to have this thing," referring to human embryo, "turn into a human." Now, at this point, I went to the transcript at MSNBC. It's one of those things in which it's almost impossible to believe that any informed or intelligent person could have made these particular statements. This is what she had to say. She was holding up a model of a woman's reproductive system, and she was holding up a little ball that was intended to represent a fertilized egg. And referring to that fertilized egg, she said this, quote, "but the very idea that this would constitute a person, right, and that some set of constitutional rights should come to this? Look, I get that that is a particular kind of faith claim. It's not associated with science. But the reality is that if this turns into a person, right, there are economic consequences, right? The cost to raise a child, $10,000 a year, up to $20,000 a year. When you're talking about what it actually costs to have this thing turn into a human, Why not allow women to make the best choices that we can with as many resources and options instead of trying to come in and regulate this process? End quote. When you think about the jumbled mass of unspeakable moral confusion that is reflected in that short paragraph, it simply requires a closer attention. Again, she refers to the fertilized egg, to a human embryo, as this thing. She says, look, I get that there is a particular kind of faith claim that would suggest that this thing she's trying to argue is a person. But then she says it's not associated with science. In other words, she says it's not scientific to believe that this is a human being or that this is a person. She calls it an it. But the reality is that if this turns into a person, so in other words, that this to which she's referring, she thinks is not a person until it turns into a person. But she clearly has no notion of when it would turn into a person. She implies no scientific knowledge, for that matter, any intelligent knowledge of what would constitute a person. She simply says that this, referring to the human embryo, is clearly not a person. At least that science would say it's not a person. It might become a person. But to use her own logic, at what point would it become a person? She simply dodges this. The implications of Melissa Harris Perry's own argument is that the this, that is the unborn human, is nothing until we declare it to be a human. That is one of the most unfortunate and tragic misunderstandings of human personhood that is now very much common in the public square. It is based upon the assumption that a human being must acquire certain characteristics in order to qualify as being a human person. But that is not only injurious to the unborn human child. That is injurious to any human being who lacks certain capabilities or capacities that someone might judge as being necessary for the acquirement of human personhood. That kind of understanding of human personhood means that anyone who falls short of a certain set of criteria is now subhuman. That is a very dangerous trajectory for the minimization and the subversion of human life and the sanctity of human life. But the language she used is what's so revealing here. Simply holding up this ball and suggesting that it represents a fertilized egg or a human embryo, and then saying that this can only be considered a person by, quote, a particular kind of faith claim, end quote. And then going on to say it's not associated with science as a way of making it sound less legitimate. But what exactly does science have to say about human personhood? Not a great deal. Not certainly in terms of any scientific consensus, which is one of the most deadly realities we face. And then turning immediately from this, that is that unborn human child, to the economic consequences of $10,000 or $20,000 a year, it's clear this is one of the coldest moral calculations I've yet encountered in terms of the mainstream media. There's been very little controversy about this, I regret to say. But nonetheless, you can look for yourself at the transcript, and you can understand just what's at stake when the human being, at any point of development, from fertilization until natural death, is reduced simply to a this that just might, quote, turn into a person, end quote. Finally, last week, a major development came in terms of the Anglican Communion, and that came with the formal installation of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. He is a 57-year-old former oil executive. The best coverage of his installation was found in the New York Times in a story by John Burns and Alan Cowell. And in it, the formal liturgy of the event is described, along with traditions, including the Archbishop turning up at Canterbury Cathedral and banging on the door with his staff in order to gain entry. What's interesting here is that even as Justin Welby is set to become the 105th Archbishop of Canterbury, and thus the leading cleric in the Church of England, and the head of the Anglican Communion worldwide, he's doing so at a time in which the Church of England is being largely evacuated, in which attendance in Church of England parishes is down below 5%, in which many churches are being sold to become pubs or to become, for that matter, mosques in terms of major British cities. There are a couple of very interesting things in this article. Of course, Justin Welby's been identified as an evangelical, but he is avidly for the service of women bishops. And he has now joined the chorus of those who are claiming that the process by which the General Synod of the Church of England is elected is simply too democratic because it allows the local people who are actually attending church to elect too many people who are opposed to women bishops. And he's calling for a change in the electoral process, a profoundly anti-democratic action by the new Archbishop of Canterbury. He also says that one day there will be a woman as his successor as the Archbishop of Canterbury. He says, quote, when the right person turns up, end quote. But one of the most interesting things about the news coverage is what is read here in this article by Burns and Cowell in the New York Times. I read, quote, "In his brief sermon at the ceremony, the Archbishop dwelt on the importance of the Scriptures in Christian lives and in the Church's struggle in the face of dwindling congregations in Britain and other Western countries to remain relevant in an increasingly secular society," end quote. I found that interesting, so I decided I would find out what the new Archbishop of Canterbury had to say as he, according to these reporters, quote, "dwelt on the importance of the Scriptures in Christian lives," end quote. So I read every single word of the message. And the message was provided by the official website of the Archbishop of Canterbury himself. Then I went back and read it again. And I cannot find any reference whatsoever to the relevance of the Scriptures in Christian lives. As a matter of fact, I could find no reference whatsoever to the Christian Scriptures at all. However, the new Archbishop did speak of the challenge of secularism and of the dwindling congregations. But then he said, amazingly enough, that he saw nothing but bright days ahead for the Church of England. This is a church that has been torn asunder by controversies over not only women priests, but homosexuality. This is a church that has been marginalized in its own Anglican communion because of its liberal positions, opposed by, for instance, conservative archbishops in Anglican churches in the global South, in Africa, and in South America. This is a church that's having to sell off its properties, and a church that was recently humiliated before the National Parliament for the fact that it was unable to do what its leadership had promised the nation would be done. But nothing but bright days ahead. All this points to the deep ambiguity at the very heart of Anglicanism, which has attempted from the very beginning to be a halfway point between Protestantism and Catholicism. It is a church that has tried to be in a middle position on so many issues for so long that it hardly seems now to recognize that the middle is fast disappearing. On questions such as the consecration of female bishops or the acceptance of homosexuality, the question is not really one that has a middle. It requires a yes or a no. And until the Church of England says one thing or another, it's likely that the Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be preaching messages about the effect of secularization and its challenge before his church. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.